Good morning, everybody. My name's Larry Thomas, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Larry.
And I'd like to thank Mike and Darren for hosting me this weekend. And the other thing that made their job real easy is they dropped me off here and they ditched me. So I'd like to thank the committee for inviting me out here to be with you and to be at this conference. I guess I am the bottom of the food chain from California. I could not think of another group of men that I would be more proud to be with than the men that I'm with California. I am very proud of my home group and my associates. I am a very proud member of the Big Book Group of Bellflower, California. And if you knew an Alcoholics Anonymous, I'd like you to know one thing, that the people that I am associated with here at this conference do not just come out once a year for a cake. They are active and alive in the program called Alcoholics Anonymous, and I see them on a weekly basis, whether I'm at their home group or they're at mine. And that's what I like in Alcoholics Anonymous, people who show up. Regardless of what their moods are, they're in AA, you see. And I'm alive and well because of a program called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thank God for the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and men like the ones that I'm with. I want to thank the committee for the basket of stuff they gave us. They had a lot of neat stuff in there. I really have all the respect in the world right now for the raisins. They're making a move, and I'm glad that I'm here. The first thing that Darren and Mike, in fact, all they talked about as soon as they picked me up was, is Larry Flint really from California? And these guys, all they did was talk about sex. And I've never been to the South, so I thought for sure they were brothers. And so I had weird perceptions of being in the South, and I haven't even met anybody named Buford. I'm glad to be here. And all I heard ever since I got off the plane was Johnny this and Johnny this. I guess my sponsor last year made some kind of trip here in the snow. And he landed in some airport, and he had to drive in the snow, or he had to capture some dogs and hook up a sled or some crap. And, you know, the snow got thicker as the day went on, you know. And I don't have a romantic story like that, but I did have a heck of a ride out here. I got into my car and driving down the 210 freeway up there and running a little late, and my glove compartment flew open. So I slammed it shut, and it flew open again. So I slammed it shut even harder, and it flew open again. So I brought it up slowly and locked it, and then it flew open. I brought it up slowly and slammed it, and it flew open. The idea of leaving the damn thing alone never entered my mind. No, sir, we're going to turn off the radio and really work this son of a bitch all the way down there. And we're not going to pull over, all right? We're going to speed up, and we're going to get that baby, man, you know. And as I stand here this morning in Huntsville, the car is parked over there at the airport, and the glove box is wide open. But you see, I've got a long ride home. And this time it's going to be different, you know. God damn right, man. So, I don't know about surrender. I have no idea about surrender. My sponsor tells me that I'm living proof that a man can stay sober for 14 and a half years and not amount to a goddamn thing. He says I'm not much, but I'm all I think about, you know. And so here I are. If you're new, I'm happy to be sober, and I know those two words don't belong in the same room at the same time. I've never been happy about being sober. The idea of sobering up in AA didn't bring on a warm glow to me, because that seemed to be my problem. I was caught in that little hamster cage of drinking as long as you can and staying sober as long as you can, and there's nothing in between. There's nothing in between. And your only hope you have is starting over. You know, and I come from a good family. The thing that bothered me about my folks and my family is the same things that bother me about people today. They treated me average. And it drives me nuts, you know. I'm the type of guy who does 8 hours of work, and I think the boss is up in the office going, Jesus Christ, man. Boy, that guy just did 8 hours of work. Isn't he wonderful, you know? And he only took a half-hour lunch, too. My God, they don't make them like that anymore, you know. I've always done average things expecting standing ovations, you know. And my dad treated me average, you know, and he'd tell me to do chores, and I thought he was picking on me, you know. And so what happens is you grow up through life with no self-worth and no confidence, always tugging on people's shirt sleeves, asking them the question, do you love me? Do you really love me? No, do you really, really love me, you know? Yeah, goddammit, get out of here, we love you, you know? You know? And then once you do charm them, and they tell you they love you, you go, oh man, how could you? I thought you had more on the ball than that, you know? God, don't love me, you know? I have, if I even smell responsibility, I'm out of there, you know? Just a whiff of being consistent, I'm out, you know? Don't threaten me with any medical benefits. I'm out of this job, you know. So I've never stayed put, and that's the only way you stay special, is you're new a lot. You have new relationships a lot. You have new probation officers a lot. You're new, you know, and that's good for a month, you know. And you're always new, and you're always running. You got wings on your feet, you know. And you spend a lifetime of trying to keep people out, and you keep them out with your anger and your hostility. And your drunken behavior, and you go home at midnight wondering why you're so damn lonely, you know. And there was always a little image to stand behind. Never let them know the real Larry. Never let them know how sensitive you really are. In fact, I pictured being sensitive as a young man as being feminine. You know, my God, you know, why do I feel this way, you know? And always ashamed of the way I felt. And I had a great mom and dad. My mom was a little Scandinavian lady, and she loved diet pills. I was born in Detroit, and foster home took us out around 4 years old, and they brought us to California. And my mom loved Dexies. My mom was always eating those green and white Dexies and running around the damn house around midnight, you know. And I caught on at an early age. If I ever wanted any love or affection from my mom, I could find her out in the garage around 3 a.m. sorting out nuts and bolts, you know. She was always eating that speed, and she loved to needlepoint. My mom was always and clicking and clacking all damn night long, you know, and everything in the house had an Afghan, you know. The chairs had Afghans, the couches had Afghans, the old man's golf clubs had little chipmunks that she knit to cover the clubs, you know. You'd go into the bathroom, and sure enough, if you needed some toilet paper, there's the pink poodle, you know, with the big button eyes, and you pop his little head off, you know, and just smoking, man. She was going. And her favorite deal was to take a couple of those Dexies, and she loved to do jigsaw puzzles. She loved to make jigsaw puzzles, man, in one setting, you know. And she'd go down to Save-On's and get her a carton of Raleigh cigarettes because they had the coupons on the back. And she'd save the coupons to buy more yarn. It was a hideous cycle she was caught up in, man, just, you know. And she'd get herself a carton of Raleigh's, you know, and get her some goofy puzzle of some just, you know, just isolate. It looked like Yuma or something, you know. And she'd bring home this puzzle and plop open that card table, you know, take a couple more Dexies and just start putting together this damn puzzle, man, you know. And she had a huge pair of toenail clippers. So if she got a piece that didn't fit, well, goddammit, she's going to piss that son of a bitch down. Put it right above my damn bed, man, you know. And I had all these goofy pictures of these places above my bed, you know. And, it'd be nothing to come home from school and see Mom moving the refrigerator by herself because she's going to do some waxing, you know. You know, but she loved me well. She was a good lady, loved me well, man. And my father was a refinery worker, so he was always coming home every week at a different hour, you know. And my dad was a happy drunk. My dad was a happy, singing the Mills Brothers, Nat King Cole drunk, boy. He loved to just get drunk and sing songs. Even if it was just one sentence of the song, man, he loved Bobby Darin. He loved singing Mac the Knife, man. 3 o'clock in the morning, the old man going, oh, the shark, babe, you know, and just stay on that damn sentence all night, man, you know. And he was a window climber. My dad was always sneaking in and out of his own damn house, you know, and always through my bedroom window, you know. I could feel that little greasy boot on my chest as he's coming in there, you know, and I remember him sneaking in there one night, and I grabbed his little boot, you know, and I said, Jesus Christ, Dad. I said, why don't you have Mom make you a set of keys, you know? For Christ's sake, she's up anyway, you know. think I can hear her out in the garage now with the Hoover going, you know, and always. So he did. He moved me out of my bedroom, and I started sleeping with my Scandinavian grandfather. There was a piece of work. Grandpa always told me that I looked better than both my sisters. That'll make you feel like a champ. That's the kind of stuff you need to hear when you're growing up, you know. And I learned to sleep with one eye open at an early age, knowing that Grandpa was in that room, you know. And there'll be no Yorkin Borkin tonight, Grandpa, you know. He loved Alabama. And I'm in the middle of two sisters. I got a younger sister and an older sister, and of course they're getting all the attention because they're well-behaved and well-mannered, and, you know, they don't get out of line and they do well, you know. And I'm not doing bad. I just feel goofy, you know. At around 11 years old, the old man came down to my bedroom and he told me that I'm going to have a baby brother. And I start planning, man. I start saving up my baseball cards and oiling up my glove and thinking about that kid brother. 9 months later, my dad came down to the same bedroom and told me that my baby brother died. And I don't remember ever having any type of compassion for my mom or any compassionate thought whatsoever. In fact, that was going to be the last brick that came in this little wall that I was building between me and my old man, me and my mom. Whatever they say, don't believe them. I blamed them for something they had no control over, you know. And I just hated that man with every ounce of hate that I could muster up, you know. And I spent a lifetime of taking my mom and dad's efforts and all their hopes and dreams and crushing them and making sure that they seen the ashes. It was their fault. And I didn't know I did that till I come to AA, you know. And around 11 years old, there was four of us across the street, and we started passing around a bottle of Four Rose whiskey. And for the first time in my life, man, I felt what other people seemed to be feeling on their own. You see, it gave to me a feeling that I couldn't muster up when I was sober. You know? And there was a connection with happiness that I'll never forget. But the one thing that I'll never forget is it didn't make me feel different anymore. And I've always felt different and secretly weird. I've always thought that I had weird stamped on my forehead, you know? And out of place and weak and stuff like that. Because when I'm by myself, I feel like just a scared little kid, man. You know, and I know I feel weird. And I can do what everybody else does during the course of the day, but they seem to be getting some kind of satisfaction out of everyday living. And I can't seem to have that. I can't muster up these feelings that shot of whiskey gave me. You know, and I'll never forget the piece that came with it. And then I threw up. You know? But I'll never forget that connection. And whenever I would get restless, irritable, or discontented, or I'd have to think of any form of responsibility, I could take a shot of alcohol. And I grew up through life from the time I was 14 to the time that I was 30. There was not one year that ever went by that I wasn't locked up for my behavior. And that don't make me an alcoholic. It makes me an irresponsible man. It makes me an irresponsible man who likes to drink and has a disease called alcoholism. And I didn't want to be responsible for anything, because when that baby brother died, it was the first death that I've ever seen. And because my ego was telling me, you're going to live forever. And that baby brother died. Nobody told me about death. I thought, well, what kind of goofy thing is this thing called life, where they create you and they kill you? What's the use? What's the use of trying at anything? And that's all somebody with sloth needs, is that what's the use? Because that keeps your effort at a minimum, you know. Try it for a week. What's the use? And I've always gave up. I've never followed anything through, because what's the use, man? You're going to die anyway. At the time I was a freshman in high school, I finally found a group of people who made me feel a part of life. And out there in California, they're called the lowriders. And I love the lowriders, man. What we used to do is lower our Chevrolet and get our hair up real big like a Bakersfield tumbleweed, man. And we'd bounce around and listen to the Four Tops and the Temptations and the OJs and Marvin Gaye. And God, I loved it, man. I was in my plumbing truck a couple months ago and the Four Tops came on and I start sinking in my damn truck, man. I loved it. I had a little Mexican girlfriend named Lupi, and she used to curl her hair up real big, you know, and she'd get her hair up real big, and sometimes she'd use these soup cans, you know, and sometimes the noodles were still stuck in the cans, you know, and I'd get my hair up, you know, and we'd bounce around all night wondering what the hell you're staring at, you know. What are you looking at, you know? I seen a kid in the mall the other day, in the shopping mall. Big old kid, man, had a bald head, and everything in his face was pierced. You know, looked like a big safety pin, man. And he had on a tank top and he had on these huge pair of drawers, man, that you could put about four or five guys in, you know. And he had on about three beepers, you know. And I walk by him, and he goes, "What are you looking at?" I says, "I ain't got a clue what the hell I'm looking at, you know? You tell me, what am I looking at, you know?" And his beepers went off, and I thought I won the jackpot, man. I don't know what I'm looking at. And we'd bounce around all day, man, and I loved it. I love that way of life, man. And I remember there was this one time, this one guy stole some dope from us, and we were going to ride over there, and we're going to get this guy. So we were drinking, and I was in the back seat, and I was bouncing around. I had a little piece of pipe with me rolled up in a magazine, and we're hitting that Tokay wine, and we bounce up through there. And these guys in the back seat are always, we were all going to go get them, I thought, you know. And there we drove up to the parking lot, and there's this big old Samoan guy, man, about 6'8". His feet were this thick, you know. And we get out of that car, you know. And I don't know about you, when anything good happens in my life, it's clipping by. And anything bad takes forever, man. Just bad things just take forever, man. And we pull up to this hamburger stand, and they push me out of the car, and they say, "Go get him, man." And I'm running after this guy with this pipe and this magazine. And click, slow motion, you know. And I start running after this guy, and I see this pipe fall out of this magazine, you know. And I'm going to hit this guy with a Life magazine, you know. Take that, you know. Get your little butt home, you know. I don't know what I was going to tell him, you know. And this old boy started kicking my butt for 2 days, you know. And the only thought that I had is, when he's done, I'm going to kick his rear, man, you know. I'll never forget that. And he took forever. And I loved that way of life. Around 1969, everybody was going places. Some of my friends were going to Vietnam, and some of my friends were going to Big Sur. And I didn't know what I was going to do with my life. So I thought, well, maybe I'd go back to Detroit and find my roots. And I wound up in Phoenix. And but I meant Detroit, you know. And I was over there off North Central and Buckeye Road at the Apache Motel. And boy, there was a place. And I'm up on the third floor, and I got the hot plate and a hot TV, and a little PM bourbon bottle cut in half, and wondering what to do with my life. And I hook up with these guys, and we start writing prescriptions. We start writing prescriptions for Seconal and Obitrol and Tuinol and you name it all. We wrote it all. And went down to Tucson, and we start passing around this paper, and I start making some pretty good dough. And they finally caught up with me in Tucson. And when you're loaded on barbiturates, there's no freeway chase. you know. There's not going to be any helicopter going, "And there he goes down the 405 freeway." You know, it's just a matter of them coming into the motel room going, "Oh, there's a little son of a bitch right there." And you wake out of it, you know, and so I do 2.5 years in Southern Arizona, and I come out of there bound and determined that everything that's happened to me because I was a teenager, you know, hanging around Mexicans and Chevrolets, you know, and I tell you, I got a weird thing happening with me, and that is, when I am sober, I have no personality whatsoever. No idea who I am. I'm the type of guy who will go into the damn wagon wheel bar, and I'm just dying for somebody to come in so I can find out who I'm going to be today. You know? And I'm just a master of voices, because you start sounding like who's ever drinking with you. You know, after 2 Boilermakers, you know, Ernie will come in there and go, "Hi, how are you?" "What? Hell, I'm doing fine, Ernie. How are you?" You know? You know, and then you go to that little Oriental bar in Gardena and have a couple Boilermakers, you know, and Futon will come in, you know, "How are you?" "You know, I'm doing fine. How are you?" You know, I don't know who I am until somebody appears, and I sure don't like who I am when I'm sober. And I'm scared when I'm sober, and my drinking is taking on a weird aspect where it's no longer a party time drinking. It is where you are just waking up, and the first thing you reach for is a bottle. Just to wake up, to open your eyes, you know. And I come back to California in 1974. I'm over in El Segundo at a Little League field, and I'm stone cold sober. And I've had a couple overdoses that my probation officer think are suicide attempts, and I'm hysterical. I'm hysterically laughing and crying, and the El Segundo police come, and they take me out of this little dugout, and they take me to my probation officer, and he doesn't know what to do with me. He's tried every imaginable remedy. He's tried counseling at the time. He's tried an abuse, and he doesn't seem to know what's going on with me. So they send me to Camarillo State Hospital for a month to be observed. And I guess they like what they've seen, because they kept me there for 13 months. And they told me the same thing that they tell a lot of people. And and that people like you don't operate out in society without some mood-altering chemical, mood elevator antidepressant. In fact, Joe Scales told me that I'd be better off if I did learn how to drink. And he gave me my little prescription and my psychiatrist to see, and he sent me off there, and I lasted 2 months. And I'm over on Alvaro Street being picked up in Los Angeles by Union Station, over there by a place called Felipe's, a little restaurant over there, being picked up for public intoxication and violation of probation. Nothing new. And so they send me to a little county jail called Wayside. And I'm up in Wayside for about 60 days, and they take about 100 of us down to the South Bay Courthouse, and they're going to sentence us, and we're going to go to our institutions. And after about 8 hours of this, they send about 60 guys to Hatchepi, they send about 60 other guys to Chino, and at 3:30 in the afternoon, I'm in a room this size all by myself, a big old holding tank. I got all my stuff in my little bag, and I'm wondering, where in the hell are they going to send me now? And in 1975, a Scottish man with a patch stuck his little head inside that jail cell. And he says, "Aye, lad." He says, "My name is Alex. Are you Larry Thomas?" And I said, "Yes, sir." And he says, "Come with me. You're going to AA. AA? I don't remember that being up north anywhere. When the hell's AA, you know? And I'm not in a black and white car, and I'm not chained to anybody. I'm in a lime green Plymouth with this little Scottish pirate, you know, and I'm kind of settling in for a long ride and maybe some lunch, you know, and he takes me 6 blocks away to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. In 1975, he takes me to this little club in Torrance called the Torrance Lamita Alano Club, and I'd never seen that word before in my life, Alano. What's an Alano Club, you know? Maybe that's a Samoan bar. I've never, you know, I've heard of elks and moose, but what's an Alano, you know? And he took me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1975, and he took me into this club and introduced me to a lady named Indian Jeannie and Singin' Sam and Captain Bob and Tennessee Bill and Singin' Sam and Serenity Sam and Bicycle Ray and Santa Claus Ray and Dancing Pete and Whistling Butt. And, you know, and I said, "My God, you know, I just left a group of people like this, you know." And little Moose, she was from Louisiana. She come running down the hallway, and she goes, "Hi, honey." She says, "My name is Moose, and I am expecting a miracle." And I said, "I bet you are, man." I said, "I'm not it, Moose, you know." And then this transvestite come out of the card room that they had. And he's a big old boy. And he come out of there, and he put his hands on my shoulders, and he said, "You know, Larry, I can't wait to take you to a candlelight meeting." I said, "I don't think so, you know. Not for that first year anyway, you know. I know you got some magic, you know, and I said, "My God, if that's AA, I don't want no part of it." I said, "If that's the effect of that little blue book, I'm not sure I want to dabble in this mess." And I was immediately out of there. And from 1975 to 1982, I came in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous on a regular basis. 30 days and get drunk, 60 days and get drunk, 90 days and get drunk. And the longest I could stay sober is because I was on heroin. And the biggest lie that I've ever told myself, if you are new, is that I was coming in and out of AA. I hadn't touched Alcoholics Anonymous. I hadn't brushed shoulders with Alcoholics Anonymous. All I did is sit in a room for an hour and a half and get miserable. And if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous and you're sitting in these rooms and you're waiting for your mind to follow, you got a long wait. I hope to God you got a sponsor that tells you more than just hang on to, you know, don't drink unless your ass falls off. I hope you've got a sponsor who gets you involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, who has you here long enough to find out what alcoholism is. And I'd sit around these rooms for an hour and a half and never do nothing. And if you don't do nothing in AA, you receive nothing in AA. You do nothing in AA, you receive nothing in AA. And you sit in these rooms and you get miserable and you say, "This ain't working either." And you leave. And all you do is get physically sober and emotionally miserable again. And if you feel like that, you say, "What the hell, I'll drink. I can drink and feel better than this," you think. It doesn't take long, and I'd sit around these rooms and in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, thinking that I was in AA. And in 1980, there's a man doing his 12-step work. And thank God for Central Office out there in Los Angeles, because every time these guys came and got me, these guys were clean and they were sharp. They were shaved and they were groomed. And they looked like people whose lives were in order. They looked like they had something going on. And every time these guys would come and get me, they asked me the same thing every time. "You ready to come back to Alcoholics Anonymous?" They never once said, "Have you been here before?" They never once said, "Aren't you the kid that robbed the Hawthorne Alano Club?" You know, they never said that. It was true, but they never said it, you know. And in 1980, I'm over there at in Wilmington at the Don Hotel on the third floor. I got a hot plate and a hot TV again. It's 10 o'clock in the morning. I got a PM bourbon bottle cut in half, and I hear this. Oh, man, it's the landlord. "Larry, it's Don." oh, my God, it's that guy from AA. I didn't even call him, and he's coming over here now, you know? Why isn't he at work, you know? I haven't worked a lick in my life, and I'm wondering why this guy ain't at work, you know? And 10 o'clock in the morning, you know, and the only thing I got going on is Jeopardy. I'm watching Jeopardy on TV, so I could really feel like an idiot, you know? Every now and then you get one right, you know? Donald Duck! Yay! God damn it. I am a smart man, you know? 10 o'clock in the morning, man, and this guy knocks on the door. And I said, who is he? He says, Don. He says, can I come in? I said, oh, man, it's that guy from AA. And he cracks open the door. He says, Larry, what the hell's going on, man? You had 15 days. You had 15 days, kid. You were going to be a janitor in the city of Lomita. There's some hope for you new guys. And I looked at Don, and I started feeling sorry for this man. I started feeling sorry for this man because I thought I was letting him down. I thought, man, I feel, God, this poor guy, man, he's really trying his best. And I'd been operating under the illusion that the man was coming to see me because I was an alcoholic. And after sitting in rooms for a little over 14 years, you people have taught me a magnificent lesson. And that man was not coming to see me because I was an alcoholic. That man was coming to see me because he was. And there was one thing that I couldn't deny. That every time these guys would leave my room, they were this high off the ground. For one reason and one reason only. They weren't me. He'd look at me and he would go, Jesus Christ, AA's working good in my life. He says, what the hell's going on, Larry? You had 15 days. And I told him that. And I took a shot off of that bourbon bottle and I said, Don, I says, you've been trying real hard. But I said, why don't you do me a favor? I said, I don't want what you got. I don't want what you have. And if I ever get that bad, I'll know what to do. Just get the heck out of my room and let me do what I want to do. It's the cry of this alcoholic, and we all have a cry. And that was mine. Let me do what I want to do. It'll be a cold day in hell before I get another man a cup of coffee in an AA meeting. It'll be a cold day in hell before I set up chairs in an AA meeting or help another man. It'll be a cold day in hell before I have a bunch of people with nicknames telling me what to do with my life. And the moment that I said that, let me do what I want to do, it shot me back to 1967 when me and my father are fighting because I'm getting kicked out of high school for selling drugs. And he has to protect his daughters, and he's kicking me out at 16 saying, get the hell out of this house if you're going to live that way. And me and my dad are fighting. My mom pulls us apart, and all I'm telling my dad is, you know, like, why don't you get off my back? My drinking ain't bothering you. Let me do what I want to do reminds me of being in that institution in Arizona, and the macho man has no place to go when he gets out. So where do macho men go when there's no place to go? They go to mom's house. And the macho lowrider's over, he's over on mom's couch, and it's 3 o'clock in the morning, and I can't find my old crow bottle. So I wrestle up enough noise to have my dear mom come down that hallway, and she says, honey, what's wrong? And I said, don't you, honey, what's wrong with me? And I start beating up my own mother till I get blood out of her nose, demanding that she come up with that bottle, because I know she's hit it. You know how they are. Just to wake up in the morning to see the basket that I had drank it all and there was the empty. Let me do what I want to do is when my best friend is drowning in front of me and he's 10 feet away over there at Saguaro Lake. We're both stone cold sober and the only thought that I have is when he's gone, I get his dope. Let me do what I want to do is why I'm in AA. Me doing what I want to do for as long as I can stand it. And all that went by my head in about 15 seconds is the only answer to life I've ever had left that room. That little bald-headed carpenter, man. And from 1980 to 1982, I'm stuck with the memory of you. And if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous and you're having trouble staying, you may leave us, but we'll never leave you. Because someday, somehow, when you least expect it, you'll be curled up in your room and you're going to snap that little seal of that Smirnoff and you're going to throw that back and you're going to think about that goof with the tie on in Huntsville. One of us with the tie on, you know. You know, or somebody here, good, bad, or indifferent, if you're alcoholic, the seed's been planted. And if you're not alcoholic, don't worry about it. It's only planted in alkies. And I couldn't get the man out of my mind. And I'm stuck with the memory of AA. And from 1980 to 1982 were the worst years of my life. Because I was destined to live on the streets. I didn't want to get off the streets. I couldn't get drunk and I couldn't get happily sober. And I thought I'd been to AA. Too scared to commit suicide, too afraid to live. Didn't know what to do, and we are caught not only with desperation, but there's got to be a little more than desperation, and I didn't know that. I've always been desperate, but there had to be a little more than that. And in May 2nd, 1982, I checked into the Beacon Light Mission again over there in Wilmington. I passed this little Woolworth window, and I caught eyes with the thing. I caught eyes with the guy that I've been running from my entire life, and there he was with his little long blonde hair and his 108-pound body, eyes bulging out, feet this thick, two different shoes on, looking at myself going, what the hell happened to my dreams? All I ever wanted to be was a cameraman. Why am I always getting drunk and why am I always getting sober? How come there isn't anything in between? And if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, you're going to hear things around AA that may confuse you. Probably most of them will confuse you. But the thing that bothers me today is when we hear people talking about problems deeper than alcoholism. And if you be an alcoholic, there ain't nothing deeper. There ain't nothing cuts the quick like alcoholism. It'll touch every area of your life and affect everybody around you. There ain't nothing deeper. You ain't got any other deeper emotional problems if you be an alcoholic who suffers from the disease of alcoholism and sobriety isn't the answer. There's nothing deeper. There's nothing worse than seeing an alcoholic sober with not doing anything about it. Nothing. Nothing worse. And you're in the only answer to life that you'll ever have. And it doesn't appear to be the answer. And it doesn't look like... Does this look like the answer to a lethal disease? No. This does not look... And this isn't the answer to your lethal disease. This is part of a big answer. This is part of a big pie, and you need the equal pieces. You need sponsorship. You need your home group. You need your commitments. You need your steps and the people you sponsor. This is part of an equal pie. And if you don't have the whole pie, you're going to die. And I didn't know that. And I checked into that mission, and I did what I always did when I checked into the mission. I panhandled some money, and I called up central office in Los Angeles. And who do I get? I get Don. Hey, Don, this is Larry. I've just checked into the mission. I'm ready to come back to AA. Will you come and get me? And he told me the most profound thing I've ever heard in my life. He says, no, you little son of a bitch. That's what he said. He says, that sign says we care. It doesn't say I'm going to take care of you. If you want to come back to AA, you know where we are. You know what we got. He says, you get your little rusty rear down here. I'm tired of chasing after you. And he hung up. I said, my God, this guy used to be so nice. What the hell got into him, man? Looked at that phone, and I said, my God. And I took the longest walk of my life. It was 11 miles. I walked from Wilmington to Torrance. And I walked up to that little Alano club. And from a block away, there were three guys standing outside of that door, and they start nudging each other and poking their fingers and looking at me. One of them was Ken O'Brien and some other guy named Ansel. And they're poking their eyes, you know, and I walk up to that club door. And that guy says, what do you want? There's no meetings going on now. There's no food. I says, I'm just wondering if Don's around. Yeah, he's around. He's inside over there by the coffee bar. He says, but don't stay long. We got a meeting going on, and we don't feel like throwing you out again. And I went up to the coffee bar, and there's this bald-headed carpenter, clean and sharped out. Clean and sharped out. And I walked up to Don, and I'd always asked him for money. And I'd always asked him for a ride. And I'd always asked him for advice. And something came out of me that I'd never asked him before. I walked up to him. I looked him square in his little eagle eyes. And I said, Don, I says, I don't know how to live. And I can't drink anymore. Would you be my sponsor? The most powerful word that ever came out of my life, man. Desperation, it says, but the admission of hopelessness. It also says that in our big book. The admission of hopelessness. And I've always had some little ray of hope. Most of it usually another drink. Most of it a little scam. And I had no hope and I was desperate and there was no other answers left. And I walked up to that guy and I said, would you be my sponsor? You're damn right I'm from California and I come from a long line of sponsorship. Sponsors who are not emotionally involved with my feelings, but they're concerned with my way of life and what I do in AA. And what I'm doing to give back. And I asked this man to be my sponsor, and he lit up like a damn tree. He got an ear to ear, and that quickly went away. And he started yelling at me for about 20 minutes, man. And I said, my God, this guy used to be so nice, man. You know. And so after the journey, we were there all day, and I shook it out with the drunks one more time, and I had the honey and orange juice, and the honey and that little bear, that little plastic bear, you know, and Santa Claus Ray and Captain Bob. I was with them all day, and they stood me up at that Thursday night meeting, and I said, my name is Larry Thomas, I'm an alcoholic. And for the first time in my life, you people were selling sobriety, and for the first time in my life, I was buying. Because there was one thing that I couldn't deny, that while I was going in and out of AA, regardless of your nicknames and your tattoos, you people were doing something that looked mighty good to me, and that was you were staying sober and learning how to live. And I just pray, God, that I could work these steps and not look like you. And now I'll just blend right in. Yeah. And I thought after that meeting, that guy was going to take me back to the mission. And on the way home, man, he gave me certain conditions that I was supposed to follow. And that he made it real clear. Now, if you don't like anything that I'm suggesting you do, you get the hell out of this car and don't waste my time. But he says, what you're going to do tonight is you're going to go to my house and spend the night. And I'm going, all right, man. A night on the couch. Oh, yes. And we pull up to his house, and there's an abandoned Toyota over there. Ain't got no tires. It's up on blocks. It looked like it'd been in Destruction Derby. He says, get your butt in that car. I says, take me back to the mission. You know, he says, get in that car. And I get into that car, and he says, you stay in this car, Larry, and so help me, if you get out of this car tonight, I'm going to call the police and have you arrested. And he slammed the door. I said, my God, that guy used to be so nice, man. He comes running back, opens up that car door, and he says, and another thing, hotshot, he says, you better find a God while you're in here. And he slammed the door again. Toyota, in the glove box or something, you know? What the hell's with this guy? 3 o'clock in the morning, man, I'm watching the trees breathe again. I'm hearing all the music, and the thought came to me. You know what, man? I don't ever got to do this again. I may have a ton of drunks left in me, but I know I never want to be new. I don't ever want to be new again in my life. There's nothing good about being new. I just don't want to be new again. I don't want to stand up. I don't want to get the chips. There was no magic left. I do not want to be new. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to do whatever this bald-headed guy tells me to do, just so I don't have to be new again. I don't want to be new again, man. And the man took me into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I stayed around that Alano Club, and I went through the steps with this man, and he immediately got me into service. And after 2 years, I survived as long as I could on the junk food of AA. And now it was time for meat and potatoes. I'd been a club guru. I knew all the steps. I got all the chips. I knew where the dances was. And I knew enough about an honest program to work it dishonestly. And I'd go home, and that anger was coming back, and that violence was coming back, and that chip on my shoulder was right there, and everything was hostile. And I couldn't sit with myself for an hour and a half. And half hour before meeting time, I'd come to AA meetings and put my AA mask on. Half hour after the meeting time, I'd take my AA mask off and live that miserable, phony way of life, thinking that you're in AA. And at 2 years sober, a man came down to this club, and he told me what I was. He says, you're an AA pimp. You're a taker, Larry. You're always going to be a loser. Takers are losers. He says, there's a triangle in Alcoholics Anonymous called Unity, Service, and Recovery. He says, I hope you find that triangle. And I followed that man. And that man's my sponsor today. My sponsor's name is Johnny, and my home group is the Big Book Group of Bellflower, California. And those are the most important things in my life today. Not because of who they are, but because of what they've introduced me to. They've introduced me to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's its entirety. And if you're new, I guarantee you one thing. What I do in between meetings is going to constitute whether I stay sober just as much as pouring your coffee. What I do when I'm away from you has everything to do with me being an AA member without letting anybody know. How I conduct myself at home, work, and play is the triangle that he was telling me about. What do you like when you leave here, kid? What do you like on that freeway? What do you like at work? You know? And I had to follow this man. And he got me actively involved in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and having commitments in meetings. And that meetings were something that you just don't go based on your mood. You were committed that you show up. You know? You show up. And he taught me about I want to tell you about sponsorship. I want to tell you what that man was able to do over the course of time. And his sponsor, and people like the men in this room. Little by little, they started teaching me about respect for the thing that saved my life. Because if I don't have any respect for it, I ain't going to serve it. And they started showing me respect for a thing called Alcoholics Anonymous, where putting on a tie and flying to Huntsville ain't nothing. Ain't nothing. Showing up to my meeting on a regular basis is. Pouring that coffee and making that... I'm just a cookie lady. That's the most I've gotten. That's the highest I need to be in AA. As a coffee maker and cookie lady, I take out the trash on Wednesday night. That's it. And my life is good today. And we took that inventory. And we made these amends
not to my dope dealer, not to me. I tell you, the two most important people on that amends list were my mother and father. And you know what? I had them all wrong. I had them all wrong. I roamed around life thinking that they never told me that they loved me. And you want to know how my little mother told me she loved me? My clothes were washed and my bed had linen on it. There was food. She cared for her daughters. She loved her husband. And she was there. She worked two jobs just to provide for us. You take that much feed, you'll work two jobs. You know. And my father. How did my father... My old man never told me he loved me. You know what, man? My dad's been waiting for me to come home and ask for help. But that god-awful pride, I couldn't ask the old man for help. I had to show him. I had to show him I could run this thing on my own. You know? And you know how the old man showed me he loved me? He had the same job for 35 years. He kicked me out of that house to protect his two daughters. He loved his wife. He reeked of responsibility. The old man's and my mother's been telling me they love me through their actions. Just like the people in AA. By their actions. And one of the hardest amends I made, I'll never forget this, because I had this romantic attitude about making amends where everybody's just going to, oh, you're so wonderful. I'm so glad you're sober now. And forget the money, you know. Just still praying for that one, you know. And man, I remember when I was a kid, there was this one guy, one of my best friends. His mother and father went on vacation, and I stole his dad's coin collection so that I could buy some more second all and sell to that kid. Good friend. And this bothered me for some reason. And I remember going up the escalator of Montgomery Ward and seeing Jeff, the kid. And I started talking to Jeff, and I said, is your father still around? Yeah, he says he's over there on Red Beam Avenue. And I said, well, I'd like to go see him. So I walked up there, and I told Johnny about the amends. And he said, yeah, go see what you can do, kid. And I walked up to that garage, and I hear this guy going, you know. And I walked up to the garage, and there's this little spotlight, and he's loading shotgun shells because he's going deer hunting. And I walk up there, and I said, Mr. Maffin? Yeah. I said, I don't know if you remember me, but my name is Larry Thomas, and I used to hang around your son. And I said, when you were gone one summer, I says, I stole your coin collection. And that thing started clicking, man. He just nuts, man. And he says, you're damn right I remember you. And he says, now get the hell off my property. He says, I want to tell you something about that coin collection, Ace. He says, when my father died, the only thing he left me was that coin collection. And you stole that from me. Now take your little $20 check and stick it where the moon don't shine and get the heck off my property. He says, I don't care if you're walking hand in hand with Jesus. You'll never repay that. And I quickly got out of that guy's garage, and I had to think, you know what, man? There's more to it than people just forgiving you because you're wonderful in AA. You really hurt some people out there. You know, there's some people you hurt by your actions. And I had to take that to heart, that poor little, because I thought about my old man. I thought about my daughter and stuff like that. I thought about people in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. I tell you, we won't have a spiritual experience about practicing these traditions in our life, and I'm not going to get on a big tradition thing, but I tell you what these traditions have done to my life, and I hope I never forget this, that they create an atmosphere where that new man can get sober. And I hope you're active and alive in your group and you're doing your commitment so that you create that same atmosphere that I have when I go to my meetings. Well, for the first time in my life, when a man's desperate and has no hope, he feels safely in admission to what he's gotten and the hope that he needs. I hope you're creating that same environment that you had when you got when you were sober. I don't need to change a thing in AA. There's nothing in AA that needs to be changed in my eyes. Things that need to be done are the things that have been done the same way, because it's worked for a long, long time. And I've got a good life today. At 10 years sober, I got the gun in my mouth. And I've got the biggest secret that I've ever had. And I don't know who to tell. At 10 years sober, I'm going to go pick up my little girl on visitation. I've been divorced for a couple years, and it's my turn to pick up my baby, Lauren. At 10 years sober, I go to the house, and I pick up my baby girl, and she comes running to me, and she hops up in my arms. And she's got a little hole in her shirt. And she's got a little hole in her elastic on her underwear. And I'm responsible for that. And I had to start seeing that, when are you going to ask for help? You see, the secret that I had is I couldn't hold a job for over 3 months in AA, for over 10 years, and I ain't telling anybody. And I look at this little girl, and I started saying, when are you going to see that your little selfishness and self-centeredness is starting to affect somebody you love? When are you going to ask for help? So I went to my sponsor, Johnny, and we started talking about this deal. And he went away for the weekend, and I talked to Clancy on a Friday afternoon. I sat down in my grand sponsor's office, and I said, Clancy, I said, I don't know what to do. I have no idea what to do, and I need some help. And he said, well, and he started giving me some techniques, and he gave me 3 things to do. He says, I want you to go find a job, just any job, Larry. He says, I want you to show up there early and stay late, and the last thing I want you to do when you leave that job is ask that boss if there's anything I can do. And he says, also, he says, when you feel crappy, he says, I want you to simulate the best attitude ever. I said, Clance, what you don't understand is after 3 months, I said, that's when I start getting goofy and I start stealing and I start getting angry. And that's when I start really feeling crappy. And he says, Larry, that's when I want you to call me in the morning. He says, I'll make you feel so crappy you'll be glad to go to work. You know? And then more important than that, he gave me a stack of papers. He gave me a stack of papers and he says, give these to my secretary. I took the stack of papers, I walked over and I gave them to his secretary and I returned. And for the first time in my life, somebody with authority told me something to do and I didn't question why. I didn't say, why me? Why don't you make her come get her own papers? Why don't you take them over? You're up anyway, you know. I mean, I never did that. I did something without debate. And I said to myself, my God, if I can do that with a boss, I got a chance here. And I went out and I found myself a little job. Now, what are you going to do with a guy like me? I don't have any education. I don't, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous made me a plumber. They took me out of the gutters and stuck me in the sewer, for Christ's sake, you know. And I've got a good job today. I work for a company, and I do all the plumbing, and I've had the same job for 3.5 years. And I go to Phoenix, and I pick up that little girl. Because if I can go to Huntsville and talk, then I can drive to Phoenix every 5 weeks and see my daughter. And I pick up my little baby girl, and she comes running down there, and she hops in my arms. And she's got some clean shirts, and her socks are nice. And she's sharp, and she's clear, and she says, I love you, and I can handle it. And I can say, I love you too, baby, and we have a good day together. I can be with my mom, and she hugs me now. She don't push me away. I could sit with my father while he's in the hospital after his fourth heart attack and grab his little frail hand and say, don't leave, Dad. I don't want you to leave, man. You've been the best friend I've had for 5 years, Pop. Don't go away yet. And he says, Larry, he says, don't wait till I'm dying to tell me that you love me. Come by and see me every now and then. That's all you ask of me. And I've got a good life today. My baby girl called me up a couple months ago and she says, Daddy, I'm having trouble in school. She says, the kids are making fun of me because I'm so smart. She said, did that ever happen to you? Like any good alky, I said, hell yeah. Just happened this morning, you know. I says, no, honey, it never happened to me. But I says, I know why it's happening to you. I says, these kids envy you because you're smart. I says, don't be anything but you are. You'll attract your own. Don't play dumb to make friends. You see, I used to take guys like that and make fun of them and steal their money and flush their heads and stuff like that when I was a youngster because you know what? Because I was an irresponsible kid. But you know what? I'll tell you what. It kept me stupid because I was afraid to excel because I was afraid somebody was going to flush my head. See? I don't have to do that anymore. I've got a good life today. I'm in the middle of AA and my life should be good. AA is designed to make you feel better. I used to come to Alcoholics Anonymous and think it would shield you from life's little bullets. What it does is sticks you smack dab in the middle of life and you better have a program because nobody cares. These people care a little. You know? These people care a little. And I've got a good life today. I've got a real good life today. All my life people have been trying to do something about my behavior. They try to teach me from the head down. Let's work on his mind. Let's work on his brain. Let's work on his, you know, his thoughts. And if you're new in AA, AA has done a miraculous miracle. They've left my brain alone. They don't want my brain. And we don't want yours, you know. What they've done is they've trained my feet. When I'm in that shower up there in Montrose, I'm going, I'm not going, I'm not going, I'm not going, I'm not going. Hi, my name is Larry. I'm totally against my will. totally against my will. Everything about AA works against the grain, which is why it works so good. Which is why it works so good. My mind has never been my friend. My mind is not happy I'm in AA. It's not going, all right, let's go to Huntsville, you know. My mind is saying, screw it. My God, let's go find Larry Flint, you know. That's what my, you know, that's what my mind, it's not a bad idea. We're almost out of here anyway, you know, so. But you've trained my feet so that I can show up at these rooms where my friends are at and my sponsors are at, and the miracle takes place little by little, minute by minute. After you're in here with your loud head and your rotten actions, you're around your people, and it takes place. And you can't fight it once it happens. You start to feel a little bit better. You can't push it down and stop it. You start feeling a little better, and you start living that way of life. Just for an hour and a half, you feel great, man. And you're glad you showed up. And you're really glad that they do. My primary purpose is to stay sober and make sure that I create the same atmosphere that some other guy's got a chance at this thing, too. It ain't about me getting mine. I got mine. Now, how am I going to take care of it? Making sure that we've got the same deal for this man when he gets here and he's desperate and alone and afraid. Back to basics, I don't know. I don't try to leave him. I try to live by him. I don't get back to nothing. I'm in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've got hands-on sponsorship, and I've got friends who are active so that when I'm feeling down, I can get in with them, and when they're feeling down, they can get in with me. Everybody has their moments, and I'm glad that I can expose them to you. I've got a good life today. My sponsor, Johnny, tells me, he says, you know, it's God's great privilege to give you a kingdom. And if you're new in AA, it's Alcoholics Anonymous' great promise for you to find that God, and I hope you do. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Larry. That was wonderful. Let's all stand, join hands, and close with the Lord's Prayer.